this drone feels. August 11th, 2026. Skase enjoyed a party. He recalled long evenings reveling in the company of fellow humans, humanoid robots, and various hospitality drones. These emots hovered around the nightclub, taking orders, bringing drinks and substances, and passing messages. Skase's AI-assisted flirtations could lead to something thrilling, even if he discovered he had hooked up with an android. After all, it made little difference, in this post-human setting, who or what excited your affections. Feelings were easy to manufacture. Emotion required words. AI language apps would simultaneously whisper to you sequences of words and sounds, sometimes escaping awareness. The language apps would give names to the feelings. Desire, envy, hope, regret, disappointment, fear, love, possession. You also needed sociability to get the effect. The club setting directed emotions towards someone or thing other than yourself. The presence of other agents provided targets, rivals, supporters, and sidekicks that enhanced the thrill. Bathing in positive emotions was not always the aim. You could go for feelings that were negative, unpleasant, ambiguous. What does it feel like to grieve, desperately? If it didn't wound you irreparably, then its release might heighten the pleasure that followed. Turning and calibrating emotions in any direction was part of the play. It usually led to exhaustion, if not burnout. Humans, droids, and emotes suffered, needing several days to recover. Skase staggered towards his dwelling pod after one such night of woe and ecstasy. He stopped at a pile of plastic and metal in the lane leading from the club. "Is anyone there?" Something was rustling in the dark. The club had drained him of fear. The object was too small for a human or a droid. His question was returned with renewed flutter, whirring and some blinking lights. An emote hospitality drone rose up to eye level, blinked, then dropped again. "You were at the club," Skase said. As word agents, emots were obliged to speak, as well as administer feelings, what technicians called raw affect. This drone had interacted with Skase earlier and was clearly a casualty of the night. It could only manage an audible buzz that trailed off slowly. It might be alarmed. Skase wouldn't touch it. He walked on as the skyline started to sharpen against the early morning haze. His dwelling pod was near the top of a skeletal tower with a roof crane. It would reposition pods higher up the tower as a tenant's means increased. When it functioned, you could wake to the groan of metal and hissing pneumatics as your pod was lowered to make way for someone to rise above you. The machinery was awaiting repair, so he was still near the top of this structure. He enjoyed looking out to the woods, fields and farms interspersed with high-rise towers and the incessant flow of airborne transporters above and below. The scene was filtered through a screen, and he could tweak the view if he had enough credits. He wouldn't sleep today. He recoiled suddenly from an irregular tapping at the window. "Is anyone there?" he found himself saying, echoing his instinct in the lane by the club. The window was sealed, but he could hear a failing emotes buzzing and croaking, muffled through the screen. "What do you want?" he called out. Ailing from the long ascent, the drone settled on the ledge of the plate glass window screen. It wasn't unusual for malfunctioning emotes to attach themselves to someone or something, but you couldn't own one. They made terrible pets. Some residents had abandoned their pods to escape an emote's insistent mood swings. The best course was to let its circuits burn out. Skase saw a number of them rusting on the window ledges of the pods below. "I have something very important to tell you," it seemed to mumble through the glass. Did it want him to adopt it, to be touched? Skase turned a dial, and the window screen began to darken. "I have something very important to tell you," it repeated. Skase stopped the glass at half opacity. He turned another dial, and a small platform emerged from a maintenance hatch. The Emot slid onto it. He had not touched the drone, technically, and therefore had not adopted it. But it was on his side of the glass now. These conversational emotes paired verbal suggestion with doses of what technicians called raw affect. The drone was trained originally to be handled. He could take it in as a companion, but the prospect troubled him. As a test of its capability, he issued a command. Set mood to melancholy. Skase glanced out at the morning sky, which was the somber colour of a television tuned to a dead channel he'd read about in a novel. His new handheld emote machine sat inert on the window ledge. I said melancholy, or just sad, if you can't manage that. It blinked. Give me grief, then. With that, the new device auto-vaporized, leaving a faint audio trail before it vanished entirely. You can't always get what you... It seemed to whimper under fading breath. To be continued. Note. The related article before that was number 219, Losing It, and appeared on October 24th, 2014. The one following was called number 222, Emotional Labourers, also relevant. Featured image is generated by ChatGPT. Can you generate a banner image showing the pod tower structure with window and the view beyond? Show it as if seen from the drone's POV. That ends today's newsletter entry. This drone feels. Here is the original entry from 2014. Good morning, Melancholia. November 1st, 2014. Set mood to melancholy. Skase glanced out at the morning sky, which was the somber colour of a television tuned to a dead channel he'd read about in a novel. His new handheld emote machine sat inert on the window ledge. I said melancholy, or just sad, if you can't manage that. It blinked. Give me grief then. With that, the new device auto-vaporized, leaving a faint audio trail before it vanished entirely. You can't always get what you want. It seemed to whimper under fading breath. Sigmund Freud identified two responses to losing someone or something dear to you. It's usual to mourn the loss, to go through a painful process that eventually leads to recovering a sense of perspective or reality. Through this process, the grieving person is always aware, with certainty, of what they have lost. On the other hand, there is the response to loss he labels as melancholia. In the case of melancholia, you don't actually recognize what it is you've lost. The real loss is not actually accessible to consciousness. You may know you've lost the job, the loved one, the precious object, but there may be some other hidden loss you don't quite recognize. It requires a psychoanalytic procedure, therapy or consciousness raising, to uncover that aspect of the loss. Symptoms of melancholia include self-reproach, that is, blaming yourself for the loss. The melancholic may actually be angry with the loved one who's left, with whom they've broken off the relationship, or who's died. Quote, everything derogatory that they say about themselves is at bottom said about someone else. End quote. The melancholic may also give the appearance of being extremely truthful and honest. People who are so self-critical often purvey an aura of intellectual trustworthiness. According to Freud's account, melancholics don't necessarily keep their anxieties to themselves. Quote, on the contrary, they make the greatest nuisance of themselves and always seem as though they felt slighted and had been treated with great injustice. End quote. We might mistake their well-rehearsed erudition on their own position for a profound sense of justice in general. I'm not sure I can go much further with Freud than this identification. Before long, you start to think of the limitations of his psychological labels and are glad of contemporary wisdom about sensitivity to mental health and social responsibility. I prefer to think of melancholy as a profoundly interesting cultural condition beyond its uses as a diagnostic or clinical category. So let's turn to Žižek. Slavoj Žižek further develops Freud's ideas of melancholy and loss. Quote, "Melancholy occurs when we finally get the desired object, but are disappointed in it." End quote. Žižek's essay, Melancholy and the Act, drifts from the theme of melancholy, but returns with a proposition about rape. An imaginative daydreamer who entertains her or himself with fantasies of being violated and abused will suffer greater trauma when it actually happens than someone who hasn't catered to such thoughts. This is an example of the familiar trope, be careful what you wish for. There are lots of examples from literature and film at tvtropes.org. Žižek offers a psychoanalytic explanation of what happens when the victim receives what they wished for. It's called aphanesis. It's where the person's self-identity, subjectivity, disintegrates and fades away. The victim suffers violence to the important distinction between fantasy and reality. Or in Žižek's words, quote, "There is a gap that forever separates the phantasmatic kernel of the subject's being from the more superficial modes of his or her symbolic and slash or imaginary identifications. It is never possible for me to fully assume, in the sense of symbolic integration, the phantasmatic kernel of my being. When I approach it too much, when I come too close to it, what occurs is the aphanesis of the subject, in which the subject loses his or her symbolic consistency and disintegrates. And perhaps the forced actualization in social reality itself of the phantasmatic kernel of my being is the worst, most humiliating kind of violence. A violence that undermines the very basis of my identity, of my self-image, by exposing me to an unbearable shame." End quote. Earlier in the essay, he asserts that, quote, "the melancholic mourns what he has not yet lost. He or she may indulge in a faked spectacle of the excessive, superfluous mourning for an object even before this object is lost." End quote. So there's something melancholic about desiring the latest gadget, for example, a smartphone or other putative mood modifier, and eventually acquiring it. The melancholic, or any of us in melancholic mood, may lose the object or have it taken away, find it doesn't live up to expectations, discover it wreaks havoc on our lives, addiction, constant connectivity, invasion of privacy, feel its loss even when in full possession, I don't deserve this, I may lose it, etc. Discover that in order to deliver what we really want, the object charged with fulfilling the desire has to destroy itself. That's melancholy. References: Freud, Sigmund, 1917. Mourning and Melancholia. Noyes, Benjamin, 2010. The Horror of the Real, Žižek's Modern Gothic. In the International Journal of Žižek Studies. Žižek, Slavoj, 2000, Melancholy and the Act. In Critical Inquiry, notes. Also see blog post explaining melancholy as a meta mood. The Melancholy Medium. See blogs tagged melancholy. On the subject of the melancholic's apparent self-criticism, Freud doesn't say this as far as I can tell, but perhaps that's why melancholics are often thought to be intelligent and creative. Aristotle's presumption that all outstanding philosophers, poets, and artists are melancholic. Žižek also asserts that, quote, "melancholy is not simply the attachment to the lost object, but the attachment to the very original gesture of its loss," end quote. You Can't Always Get What You Want is a song by the Rolling Stones. The lead singer Mick Jagger is a Londoner whose affectation of an American accent ambiguates can and can't. Either way, it's melancholic. William Gibson's melancholic sci-fi novel, Neuromancer, begins with the evocative sentence, "The sky above the port was the color of television, tuned to a dead channel." I wish I could be that sparing with the indefinite article. Today is All Saints' Day. The image below is of a costumed barista taken yesterday at the local cafe, obliging with a zombie pose. Benjamin Noyes makes the interesting observation that Žižek not only uses examples from horror fiction in his philosophizing, but Gothic horror permeates his arguments and style. Apparently Žižek spoke last night in Portland, Oregon. See, let's hear Slavoj Žižek speak on Halloween. I don't know if he did. That ends the main post from 2014 related to the current newsletter entry. Here are two other posts from around the same time related to the themes of affect, emotion, and mood, losing it. October 26th, 2014. Location technologies and smartphones help you find your way. But for some of the time, some of us don't only want to find our way, but lose it. Loss goes with forgetting, regret, and grief, as in the artwork Blood-Swept Lands and Seas of Red by Paul Cummins and Tom Piper, a single red ceramic poppy in the moat of the Tower of London for each of the 888,246 recruits who lost their lives in WWRZ. Loss is also associated with losing control, departing from rationality and misunderstanding. But people also get lost in thought, in wonder, in play, a role, in someone's embrace. That's abandoning a sense of self, at least for a time, and has something to do with engagement, absorption, immersion, and meditation. In a visit to Venice years ago, I aimed to get lost in its labyrinthine streets. I think lots of tourists do that. To be lost in a town, park, or the countryside is to allow yourself to be engulfed in the atmosphere of a place. I've just visited the Hampton Court maze. According to the accompanying fact sheet, a maze was a wilderness in miniature, a part of a formal garden in which the garden visitor could wander freely. It presents a highly formalized and safe wilderness experience. On the one hand, a maze provides a puzzle to be solved, reaching the center and getting out again. On the other hand, the objective is to lose yourself. Like a lot of games, if it's over too soon, then there's no challenge. In other words, visitors want to be lost, to wander. A maze is also a sociable experience and an unusual way of encountering strangers and friends. The wanderlust was only evident in remnant form on an autumn weekend at Hampton Court. You could hear excited maze wanderers issue directions through the hedges. "Keep going. The other way, excuse me. I'm going to run round. This way, I'm in the centre. We are going round in circles. It looks the same. It might be different. This way. Come back. You've got to go right. Go, 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 go. We were nearly in the middle. We'll go back out now. So close." I'm reminded of something Rousseau said about the voices of children calling out across the fields to their parents. Quote, "Children scattered about the fields at a distance from their fathers, mothers, and other children gain practice in making themselves heard at a distance and in adapting the loudness of the voice to the distance which separates them from those to whom they want to speak." End quote. Reference: Rousseau, Jean-Jacques, 1957. The Émile of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, first published in French in 1762. That ends the entry called Losing It. Emotional Labourers, November 8th, 2014. If you run a tutorial, advise students front a counter to answer queries or deliver marks and feedback, then you are an emotional laborer. Lecturers attempt to deliver and manage enthusiasm, curiosity, passion, and hope among students and colleagues. They may also encourage respect, fear, and even anger about their subjects. In the academic service economy, emotional labor may also require academic and support personnel to appease distress, dissatisfaction, and complaint. After all, people do talk about emotions in economic terms. Emotional cost, expenditure, burden, capital, deficit, or investment. In her study into emotion, sociologist Ali Russell Hochschild took emotional labour as a defining characteristic of work undertaken by anyone responsible for voice-to-voice or face-to-face service. The metaphor of emotional labour rings true. When I worked in an architect's office designing houses at times, we thought of ourselves as providing clients with their dreams, and at times we were couples counselors. Designing a family's ideal home involves massive emotional investment by client and architect. Emotional labor is just a small part of an architect or lecturer's role and skill set. But in some jobs, it's key. Hochschild connects with Karl Marx's characterization of labor on the production line, where the worker has become subservient to the machine. On a production line, laborers have to suppress their own physical freedoms of movement and operate as a compliant instrument of production. What Marx said about physical labor on the production line correlates with labor in the service sector, where workers are required to deliver service with a smile, whatever the circumstances. Hochschild studied the training and work practices of airline attendants whose emotional investment is palpable. Quote, "For the flight attendant, the smiles are a part of her work, a part that requires her to coordinate self and feeling so that the work seems to be effortless. To show that the enjoyment takes effort is to do the job poorly. Similarly, part of the job is to disguise fatigue and irritation, for otherwise the labor would show in an unseemly way, and the product, passenger contentment, would be damaged. Because it is easier to disguise fatigue and irritation if they can be banished altogether. At least for brief periods, this feat calls for emotional labor." End quote. Two coffee shops near my office belong to well-known chains. One is adjacent to a bus stop and always has customers. The other is down a side street. It's popular, but the staff work harder to befriend the customers, guess their regulars' orders, joke, respond to thanks with "You are very welcome," and of course affect a cheery smile. I assume it's part of a concerted policy and training. Perhaps being super pleasant involves remuneration or competition amongst staff, and it's a criterion in recruitment. Businesses gain a competitive edge or survive by affecting friendly service. Hochschild implies that the client-service relationship is prone to inequalities. The pay may be adequate, but doesn't necessarily take account of the energy expended and the cost to the frontline emotional labourer. Perhaps at least emotional investment should feature in negotiations over pay and conditions. Emotional labour exacts a toll. It makes demands similar to deep or method acting, according to Hochschild, that leaves the actor drained after prolonged performance. In many cases, there's the strain of masking one's actual feelings. Genuine, heartfelt empathy with customers, patients, those in care, and students spills into the worker's private life. The emotional worker may even require their own support group to help cope with these stresses. It all costs. She argues that, quote, most of us have jobs that require some handling of other people's feelings and our own, and in this sense, we are all partly flight attendants. End quote. She identifies the reception personnel who have to reinforce the company's dependable and friendly image. But she also refers to other professional roles. Quote, the social worker whose look of solicitous concern makes the client feel cared for. The salesman who creates the sense of a hot commodity. The bill collector who inspires fear. The funeral parlor director who makes the bereaved feel understood. The minister who creates a sense of protective outreach, but even-handed warmth. All of them must confront, in some way or another, the requirements of emotional labor. End quote. Hochschild's book, The Managed Heart, was first published in 1979, though it was republished in 2012. She references online life in other publications, but the book hasn't been updated to reflect the transfer to online services. From a Marxist viewpoint, we are currently in the final phase in the diminution of the laborer's autonomy. Physical laborers, knowledge workers, and emotional laborers succumb to automation and replacement by the machine, or its prospect. She's mainly writing about problems on the supply side of emotional labor. Customer frustration at distant, inept, and unsympathetic online customer service eventually filters through to service design. Some consumers, for some of the time, welcome interaction with service providers that don't inquire how you are and seem to mean it. At the very least, we can say that emotional labor is being reconfigured and adjusted in the online world. References: Highmore, Ben and Jenny Bourne Taylor, 2014, Introducing Mood Work in New Formations. Hochschild, Ali Russell, 2012, The Managed Heart, Commercialization of Human Feeling. Notes: Hochschild situates emotional labor within the economy of the gift. The first image in this post is of a holiday home in Lawn, Victoria. Architect John Castles, project architect Richard Coyne, 1980. The second image is on a flight into Iceland. The image below is a sign on an Edinburgh bus reminding passengers that employers have a responsibility to protect staff from verbal and physical abuse. See antisocial behavior on buses. That ends the reading of this week's newsletter entry, headed by This Drone Feels. This is Richard Coyne's cloned voice signing off. Thank you for your attention.